Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It is September 18th, 2019. And it's come to my attention that a few of my opponents online are claiming that 3 years ago I was excommunicated from the church. That's typical of, you know, internet rumor mongering. That was never the case. I resigned from the Synod of Milan one day before I was going to be tried for my positions on so-called name worship and philotism. I am part of the Russian Orthodox Church under Damaskin of Moscow now. I was supposed to be defrocked, not excommunicated. So I don't know where that came from, but people will invent whatever they want. And that was 3 years ago, almost to the day. Anyway, as always, I called on my friends to support me in any way they can. My situation continued to deteriorate. I appreciate those who have already assisted me. My website is rusjournal.org, and I appreciate that has everything there, my articles, links to this site, all my books, you know, the Patreon, everything else, and a place to donate. And as most of you know, I don't need much. I don't really do much, since I'm mostly a recluse anyways. So most of my actually every penny goes to, you know, basic expenses or research expenses, which sometimes can be substantial. Today I want to go to my roots as a scholar. I tend to be kind of all over the place. You know, I could be talking about, you know, music history one day. I could be talking about the president of Kazakhstan another day. I could be talking about Indonesia the next day. But understand that they only seem to be scattered. In fact, they're not. They really have one concept that unifies them all. And that is the Orthodox idea found in the Old Testament, but is found in world history uniformly. That in politics, humanity in any nation that they find themselves has a choice. Either monarchy or oligarchy. There's no third option. There's no in-between. You can't have a sort of oligarchy. The only time that might work is very, very temporarily, while an oligarchy is waiting for their time to destroy their enemies. So-called constitutional monarchy is one of these hybrids. That's just a way to bring the crown under control so that any financial problems can then be blamed on the crown rather than themselves. And of course, I use these terms very generally. And I've said this before, I'll say it many times again. You know, monarchy is the notion of a unified national power. It could be military, it could be royal, it could be, you know, like the Cossack Hetman, it could be anything. It could be strictly religious, like in Iran. But what keeps it together is that the common good, natural law, is absolutely essential. The state is strong. There's a strong public ideology that forces the elites to serve the public good. When that decays, and we see this in the Killing of the King ritual, where sons of the monarch conspire to kill him because their jealous access to women. Of course, this is partially a Freudian idea, but certainly it goes back to the Masonic lodges long before, and certainly even before the French Revolution. And that in killing the king, they're able to then take over and share in that power that's now been removed. The problem that oligarchy always has, and oligarchy is pretty much the same, unlike monarchy. It could be anything from a strong president to a military government to a crown head, but they function like a monarch. Oligarchs are based on money. There really is nothing else that, at least realistically, that any elite can have from which they rule. Now, the problem there is that it's pretty rare that they come right out and say, this is what we are. Now, 10 years ago in the Washington Post and New York Times, you had journalists and scholars coming right out and saying that oligarchy is the right government for Russia. You know, the capitalists need to rule. You know, the leftists in America saying the capitalists need to rule the Russian Federation and there should be no central power. That the oligarchs were good guys. So you did have occasionally people, especially when there's a Jewish connection, you do have some people who openly came out and said oligarchy is better. But that's very rare. What oligarchy does is that they couch their self-interest in universal terminology. So during the French Revolution, the notion of individualism and the freedom from tradition and class in the corporate sense, sounds like this tremendously universal notion. And who could argue with that? Except that who it referred to were those people who already had money, especially in the legal profession, those who already had money, those who already had power, that once the monarchy was to fall and the prohibitions on usury and all this other, all the financial laws were to go away, the guilds were to be banned and everything else, that they would immediately take over. Whenever we study history or any political ideology, or when people are talking to us about ideology, the question needs to be, well, when the government that you don't like leaves, what takes over? Don't talk to me in abstractions. I want to know who benefits here. As I've said before, no one dies for abstractions. No one goes to their deaths in warfare chanting war songs about trial by jury or abstract freedom of expression. No, they die for very specific things. They die for the fatherland, for hearth and home. They die for their family. They die for a nation and a specific point in time. Those are not abstractions. These are cover stories. No one gets excited. It's like in the Hong Kong rioting. I talked about that last week, or I think 2 weeks ago. The American press, knowing that Americans don't know anything about Hong Kong, says that this is about an extradition bill. The Chinese government is demanding the right to any criminals in Hong Kong to be extradited to China. As if rioting by thousands of people over months can come from an abstract bill like that. A bill which, by the way, doesn't even exist anymore. Of course it's not about that. There's always something else. There's always something more specific. And they use these universalistic sounding phrases, you know, freedom of speech, whatever it is. You know, people don't talk about freedom of speech unless they're already dominant, unless they're already in a position to make good use of it. No one dies for abstractions. That's not what this has ever been about. So this is how oligarchy functions. One of the weapons that they use is when talking about royal governments in the broad sense, that they'll talk about republicanism and democracy as ideals. They'll use nothing but abstractions to talk about it. They'll talk about freedom of assembly. They'll talk about voting. They'll talk about parties. They'll talk about, you know, campaigning. But when they criticize their opponents, They'll talk about crowns and military governments as they actually functioned day to day. Marxists are famous for doing this. They talk as if their ideology has already been realized. You know, don't you want workers to be liberated? Don't you want workers to have the full value of everything that they make and not to be alienated anymore? No, you can't talk about abstractions like that. That hasn't happened. You need to talk about how Marxist governments actually function day to day. Then we can have a conversation. Most of the political debate, which is largely mediated by the press anyway, which is what the word media means, is so scripted and corrupted, it's really worthless. Given that, I want to talk about power. I've made a big deal in my career in making a very strict distinction between power and authority. Anyone could have power over you. Power is a quantitative term. It's not connected with any content. There's no moral end to it. You know, cancer could have power over you. A gang that comes into town can have power over you. A drug dealer can have power over you. But has nothing to do with political rule. We're talking about strictly coercion here. And yet power and authority are almost always conflated. There's nothing wrong with coercion. There's nothing wrong with violence. There's nothing wrong with destroying your opponents under very specific circumstances. But the right people have to do it for the right reasons and under the right conditions. That could be an act of love. The destruction of these pagan societies in the ancient Near East, the Israelites were commanded to slaughter, this was an act of love. Had these people been allowed to continue, they would have spread their filth. We don't know a tenth of what these people were doing. It was horrifying what these tribes were doing. This is the conditions under which they were eliminated. The culture had become so perverted that they had to be destroyed. Sodom and Gomorrah is an obvious example here, or let alone the flood. That is also an act of love. God doesn't condemn anybody. Our conscience condemns us. The judgment has nothing to do, and I hate people who use the metaphor of a courtroom to refer to what the judgment is going to be. That's absolutely, I mean, I know they only mean it as a metaphor, although sometimes they mean it literally. It's still the wrong one to have. We are the judge. The difference is that we're not allowed in that condition to use excuses. We can't lie to ourselves. We can't use equivocation. We can't use defense mechanisms. We can't deny. We can't project. We can't deflect. We can't gaslight. We can't do anything like that. It is purely honest. What would we act like if we had a completely honest conception of ourselves? That's what heaven and hell is. Of course, it's the same place. All the church fathers said that. The difference is how we end up judging ourselves, what our conscience says. Where do we belong? Our conscience, as so many church fathers said, is almost infallible. But of course, in this society, we lie, we cover it up, we manipulate, we use words to equivocate. You know, we all do this. I mean, we need to avoid it, but no one's completely innocent of it. The judgment is a condition where that can't be done, where it is pure honesty. That's a completely different story. And if you were to give a completely honest, I mean, people go to great lengths to avoid honestly looking at themselves. This is what heaven and hell is as far as the judgment is concerned. There is no legal order here. Legality is just an abbreviation, a very, very brief understanding in some sense what we're supposed to do. but that I've dealt with on the Vicious Latsiev, my lecture and so many others, laws are problematic. They're written on paper. That means they use words. That means they can be manipulated. Definitions change. People can read whatever they want into any text they're looking at. When people follow the law, they do it not out of love, but just to get the reward. Then they say, okay, I'm owed it. So if you follow the laws and the commandments, you go to God and you say, okay, I'm owed heaven now. Give it to me. That's not how it works. But that's what the law creates. And St. Paul says. So much about the Orthodox tradition, especially the Russian Orthodox tradition, isn't understood in the West. It's not understood in Russia either. It's so far from the modern Protestant idea, because the Protestants that rule the churches in most of the United States would have been considered, even just a couple hundred years ago, the most radical and extreme of the Puritans. Now remember, the word Puritan has nothing to do with their behavior. It has to do with purifying it from any kind of papal liturgical association. The Bible can't be read by just anybody. I've said this 1,000 times, I'll say it 1,000 times more. But people will read this like they're picking up a magazine on the toilet, and they'll, you know, bet their lives and they'll bet their souls on what they think they read here, despite it being, you know, a text that's 3,000 years old. Now, we're not necessarily talking about politics here. The Old Testament, which is the majority of the Bible, in fact, the overwhelming majority of the Bible, is an intensely political book. That's 90% of what it is. So the political agenda for what the Christian mind is laid out. It can't be denied, which is one of the reasons that it's being ignored. And Bibles are being printed just with the Psalms and the New Testament. Well, the New Testament doesn't make any sense without the Old, because Christ was constantly making reference to the Old Testament prophets. So I want to talk about monarchy in terms of legitimacy. Now, there's a few authors that I've been reading recently, Father George Titov, M.V. Nazarov, who I've been reading for many years, hero monk Alexei Eisen, contemporary writers that are connected to the Union of the Russian People. And that website, by the way, is one of just one of the best collections of academic and popular articles on these topics out there. So the problem is that when people read texts in the Bible, they read it in complete abstraction. To abstract something means to take it out of its context. It's not just a cultural and political context, but it was also put together by who we call the Church Fathers that created the authoritative interpretation of it. So you consider it like the Federalist Papers vis-a-vis the Constitution. And often people quote the New Testament, especially, usually a mistranslation, to support some agenda, and they have no idea what they're talking about. And one of these famous ones is Romans 13. May every soul be submissive to the higher authorities, etc. Now, this is something that the Protestants have done a lot of damage with. The actual translation here is that there is no authority other than God. If you go to the Old Slavonic and the Greek before it, it has nothing to do with there being that every power is somehow of God or established by God. That is simply false. There are powers, but they're not necessarily authorities. The proper translation, whether it be in the Old Slavonic or the Greek, is because there is no power if not from God. And The concept is, power is connected with legality, not the mere existence of coercion. Evil regimes, you know, a biker gang comes over and takes over a town. God may have permitted that to work because he gives us free will to some extent. That doesn't mean this is a divinely sanctioned government or even a government at all. The issue is that if it's not a divinely sanctioned government, you can't call it a government, and it has no legitimacy. Sila is the Russian word for, and also the Slavonic word for force, for the capacity to use force and violence. Sometimes it's translated as strength. Your Lithuanian sila can be soul or spirit. But spirit in the sense of being spirited. It refers to everything from the force of governmental action to a punch in the face. And it's a very ancient, it's a proto-Slavic term. It's a very ancient word. Authority, though, is vlast in Russian. It's inherently a political term. We get words like volos from it, like the old Russian county. It's not just legal force, but the legitimate use of legal force. The most ancient usage of the word is to rule as a verb. Inherently, it has nothing to do with coercion. And that's reflected even in the English. You could say that someone's an authority on American politics. But it doesn't mean that they have any power over it. An authority refers to a command of the information, connection with the knowledge and the sources of knowledge. That's what an authority is. They would have a right to have power over it, but the way things are, the best people often have nothing to do with the levers of power because the best people often don't want it. So the concept of authority, I mean, the old Czech word vlast is rendered often as homeland. So it's not just authority. It's not just legal authority. It also is legal authority that derives from the nation. So what Paul's talking about isn't just whoever happens to rule at the moment, but if a society is to be obeyed, it has to demonstrate – sorry, if a government is to be obeyed, it has to demonstrate that it is of God. Now, there's a few ways that authority is given from God in the Bible. The first is, when it comes to politics, is direct testimony of revelation through the prophet. Now, we're talking about the prophet Samuel that consecrates the first monarch, as we all know. Patrimonial succession is the second, which is Luke 1, verse 32. Then number three, and this is all over the Old Testament, is the spiritual moral state of the society. If the moral content of society collapses, all other things being equal, it is not from God. It doesn't mean it doesn't come, you know, God allows things, but it doesn't mean that he creates them. On Psalm 80, we read, but my people did not listen to my voice, and Israel didn't obey me. So I gave them over to their stubbornness of their heart to walk in their own devices. Sin has a tendency to be its own punishment. Things like envy are painful just to possess. Your gluttony is painful. It could destroy your body. Overindulgence. So sin has a tendency to be its own punishment, especially over time. But it really was the Protestants in Martin Luther's day, and we're talking about his famous essay on repressing the peasant revolt in 1525, which is I think maybe the first time this is mentioned. And he says the peasants should be killed, they should be destroyed, because they're violent, they're rising up, and the foundation for it is that they are fighting the governing power. Now remember, in Protestant states, early on, since the Catholic Church had been gone, was removed, the monastery lands were secularized and given over to the elite. So many, you know, parishes and certain treasures were all given over to those who were ruling the state. The state grew tremendously in power. The state took over religious education. The church, in essence, almost became a private matter, and the state ruled over all. This was the initial Lutheran idea. And when he wrote it's a brief essay. It's called Against the Robbing and Murdering Hordes of Peasants. He's very clear that it's because it's in violation of Romans 13 that these peasants are to be judged. Justice doesn't even come up. Justice doesn't come up at all. So the normal, the way that most people use the phrase Romans 13, all power is from God, therefore you have to obey the government, is utter nonsense. And it confuses power and authority. Because if it's true, then on what grounds did the Serbs throw the Islamic Muslims out in the 19th century? On what grounds did the Americans throw the British out? Was the Soviet government, or the Chinese government, or the Khmer Rouge, were these also sanctioned by God? Or the oligarchy that took over Russia in the 1990s, or this government? But the church defines patriotism as a religious duty and a spiritual virtue. But there is no place for any kind of patriotism if all power is from God. Because there has to be a common good that a nation represents. How would one government differ from another if everything is from God? And of course, finally, if you believe that, and many people do, then the coming Antichrist will also be from God. If all governments are equally from a divine origin, then how would you interpret Satan's words when he tempts Christ and says, all of these cities and powers I will give over to you? From Luke 4. In other words, he already owned them, and he would give them over to Jesus if he would bow down and worship him. For those legitimate states, for those governments at all. Now, the common good is what matters. Natural law is what matters. And Orthodox canon law is what matters. Voting, as you know, I've never voted a day in my life. And I understand why some people will do it, especially in this day and age. But voting implies that the legislature, filled with politicians that essentially the media puts in power, is somehow legitimate. And in fact, they have power over legislation, which they do not. And therefore, it's a government, which it is not. No politician can function at the national level without full media support, or at least media recognition. An issue, you know, think of the big issues of the day. Well, who decides that? Well, there was no huge groundswell of a demand that transsexualism should be an issue. That was forced on everyone by the Jewish press. And yet it's this press that puts politicians in the public eye. They decide what's legitimate and what isn't, what's real and what isn't. Not to mention, it creates party divisions within the church itself. In the Moscow Patriarchate today, there is in their service book, there's a line in the consecration of a bishop, and the bishop has to take an oath that says that he'll be loyal to the authorities of God-protected Russia. Now, today it's one thing, but 25 years ago it was something different. 40 years ago it was something different. I noted that in the, I think I mentioned this before, in the anathemas on the Sunday of Orthodoxy, it affirms that Catherine the Great, Peter the Great, and God forbid, Catherine the First, are legitimate God-fearing rulers of the Russian government. And opposing them is a problem. It lists them as legitimate Christian governments and God-protected and God-inspired, which is utterly laughable. So where does this oath come from? Oaths like this is one of the reasons the old believers took the vehement stands that they did. It implies that whatever government is there has the same goals as the church. What powers are they referring to? And not to mention, what if real power isn't in the state at all? It's either authorities or governing authorities. But that could be oligarchs. That could be the private sector. That could be Jews living in another country. And what does loyal mean? This is the old Shergian idea, but it also comes from Peter the Great that demanded that bishops take an oath to him. And that was another huge reason that the old believers exploded and became this huge force the way it did. Given all of this, the Leninist concept of the separation of church and state is false. First of all, the concepts are misstated. The church isn't just bishops sitting in a room. You know, the church is the presence of grace on earth. It's God's manifestation on earth in every way that the church permits it. Everything from our knowledge, our icons, our liturgy, our day-to-day life. That's the church. And by the state, it could mean a whole bunch of different things. We're talking about the common good. And in these societies, centuries ago, we're talking about the emperor. Today, of course, government doesn't actually control much. Government is reactive, not proactive. The private sector has largely taken over government anyway. And Alexei II said in 2006, he said, "Rapprochement and cooperation with the government is not a merger. I am a staunch supporter of the separation of church from state, as I've said many times. I believe that if the present historical stage in the Orthodox Church in Russia does not exist as a separate institution, if it does not exist as a separate institution, it will turn into a department of state. It will have negative consequences for the church, for the state, and for the society. The church was such a department before the 1917 revolution." Now, what he's saying there, he's referring to the Petrine Synodal College after the abolition of the Patriarchate and his extreme methods in purging the church. That was a disaster. Most of the saints from that moment on condemned it. Many saints went to their deaths protesting it. But that can't be the reason that you believe that the church and government should have nothing to do with each other. The first person to utter that phrase, separation of church and state, was Lenin. That was the name of the first law, a very early law that he forced through to completely remove the Orthodox Church from the day-to-day life of Russian politics. Now, a monarchy is a monarchy in the sense of the Tsar or the Byzantine Emperor. This is a religious office. This is not a political office. It's primarily a religious and ritualistic one. It is, therefore, a denial of the monarchy, if this is really what he means here. Don't forget, one of the, you know, people spend a lot of time condemning Patriarch Sergius for what he wrote in 1927, saying that they're going to support the fundamental goals of the Soviet state. And he played with words here and there. He tried to be, nice about it. The Soviets actually wrote it for him, but, you know, they gave him some wiggle room. But however you slice it, you know, he associated himself with the government and then denied that there was any persecution of the Orthodox Church from there on in, despite him having been in prison himself. Now, while that's the wrong thing to do, it's hard to judge him, as I've said many times, because, you know, the torturous death that awaited him if he didn't do that. And of course, they also threatened many, many priests and bishops. If you don't sign this thing, we're going to kill those guys. And so he did it. He wasn't a Marxist by any means. But this is what he thought he was doing. But something happened just before then. And Alexei mentions it in 1917. 1917 wasn't the Bolshevik Revolution. That was the White Coup, where a handful of army officers got rid of Tsar Nicholas. He didn't resign from office. That resignation letter is a forgery. I've dealt with that, I think, last year in some detail. It's a common opinion in Russia, too. The signature is forged, and it was done on a typewriter. And everyone, you know, who knows the situation, royal decrees had to be done in handwriting. There was no seal. It was a bad forgery written by one of the generals at the front. It was a military coup. The overwhelming majority of the church, in terms of when I say the church, I mean the bishops, supported this and supported the Kerensky state. There were a handful, Macarius of Moscow being one, that stayed loyal to the crown. Their reasoning also was that the Petrine College, which made the bishops of that part of the church, the Department of State, taking old independence away from it, was a terrible thing. And it was. And they did do damage to the church in the 18th century. But that's not a legitimate reason to want the entire monarchy to be overthrown. So his position on church and state, especially in the Russian case, is untenable. And it all depends on how we define the word politics. Church and state, in its most common use, comes down to the fact that church, Christianity is what we're talking about here. We're not in India. This is Christianity. Would have a strong influence, officially, on certain state decisions. It has nothing to do with it being a Department of State or anything else. You know, in Greece, you still have that. You still have the Orthodox Church having an official presence in government. That is a good thing. It makes perfect sense. The Church has every right to be there. They don't rule directly, of course. The Cyprus thing was an anomaly. They don't rule directly, but they have a role. Almost like the bishops in the old House of Lords. They certainly have a role. And because it is the historically dominant institution that saved the country from endless, you know, torments centuries ago, and has defined the nation over time, they have every right to be in charge of certain things. When a monarch is chrismated at the altar, he is, or at least the Western Roman emperors were, subdeacons. They were members of the clergy, and they took communion behind the iconostasis at the altar. That's the West and the East. They weren't just an ordinary layman. It wasn't a secular institution. The state needs to reflect what the Orthodox kingdom, which is what the church is, the church building, the structure of it, and what the monarch is. We're so used to thinking of the state as a secular institution, as, you know, bureaucracy and procedures and punishments and law and court cases and everything else. That's an aspect of it. That's not it in its entirety. But of course, we live in an age of such corruption, it's almost impossible. But for Alexei to say that, and most of the patriarchs in the Soviet era and post-Soviet era have said this, they're violating a few things. First of all, it completely goes against the Old and New Testaments, the canons, the decisions of the ecumenical synods, all have given the church a place in certain aspects of the state. It puts a seal of approval on the decline of Christianity in the public realm. It gives the Antichrist far more freedom to function, especially in the Russian case, because the Russian Tsar was the restrainer, as we all know, the Kathon, the one who holds, one who fights the son of perdition. When Tsar Nicholas was forced out in a coup in 1917, the world was never the same again. Millions immediately died from a massive influenza outbreak. I talked about that last year for the 100th anniversary of the murder of the royal family. And then the day he was executed, it was discovered a new strain of it that was almost impossible to get rid of. It was the greatest epidemic in world history. It killed tens of millions of people. And people forget about that, I think largely because of its connection with World War I and the overthrow of the monarchy. Of course, it insults the memory of Russian monarchy and the Russian princes of the past. And so many of them are saints who made Russia into a great power. It condemns all of Russian history up until the Soviet era. And most importantly, it spits on the unity of the church, both in its heavenly and earthly realms. It's an error to hold. Archbishop Avrakki used to say this. It's an error to hold that the kingdom is just not of this world. Of course, it's not of this world in the sense that it doesn't take part in the power structure of the world. That doesn't mean it has absolutely no presence in our world. It's above it. It has more legitimacy than it. And the worst part of about having power is that you're forced to partake in the day-to-day power struggles of politics, which is awful. Now, the church is of this world in the sense that it deals with natural law and justice, not the day-to-day struggles of warfare and bureaucratic wrangling. And he argues essentially that in saying the church and state should be separate, that his own political role is irrelevant. So only good can come from God, but that can be complex. What we think is evil at the moment really isn't. Pain normally is a very good thing. There are people out there who can't feel physical pain. I can't think of the name of the disease. Their lifespan is about 32, 33 years because they have no idea if something's wrong with them. They have no idea. I mean, what is pain? Pain is your body saying that there's something wrong. It is not a bad thing, even suffering. Generally speaking, I mean, it's as you're going through it, it's not a great thing. But so many of us realize that periods of suffering were where we became who we are, how we became tough, how we understood who we were, who we found out who our friends are. These aren't unequivocally evil things. So even pain and suffering and death isn't necessarily evil. The improper understanding of that stuff is. But the improper understanding comes from humans' free will. The following of their own fantasies and images, what they think the world should be, their own power, their own self-interest, versus the truth of the matter. Evil is a demonic product because of corrupted human nature. And these are the vices that infect us, that infect every one of us. We choose between good and evil, but that's not just a choice for, you know, relative to an act. It can come to that, but it has far more to do with how we organize our mind, how we organize our lives. Adultery is a horrible sin. Of course, we no one denies this. But the sin isn't really so much the act, but what was wrong with you in the first place that you thought you needed to do it, or you thought it was okay to do it, or that you rationalized and justified you doing it. That's far more severe than the act itself. If you're a drug addict and you finally get clean, the first thing you have to do, of course you have to live a different life, but you have to realize, well, why was I doing drugs in the first place? And if you don't solve that, you're not going to be clean for long. So the notion that all power is from God, no matter what it is, this is a common Protestant idea. And in Russia, it came into existence through the so-called Bible Society. I actually talk about these guys in my first book, The Third Rome, organized in 1813. It was finally shut down in 1826 because of its deeply Masonic connections and deliberate mistranslations. They're still around, though they're not a Department of State like they used to be. And they're heavily Protestant in their orientation. The connection of Romans 13 to Martin Luther's attack on the peasantry and things attached to that is very clear. It's impossible. I mean, you know, I've heard Protestants, even Catholics, talk about you can't disobey the state, and they quote that line. And yet, we talk about the Soviet power, or the rule of Julian the Apostate, or even the present American regime that exists to destroy the religion that's to be found in the Bible. And to the extent that you don't fight it, you partake in its sins. I don't care how small of a role it is, to the extent that you don't fight it, you partake in its sins. The concept of that Romans 13 that's used all the time and misused all the time is that the sword has to be used for goodness. The sword is not used in vain, is one of the translations of it. It's not just the use of the sword as such, and by sword, generally speaking, we mean coercive power. For Martin Luther, he meant that literally. But that it has to be used for good. It has to be law-bound, and it has to be based on the common good. Now, what does that really mean, though? John Chrysostom says, and actually he's talking about Romans 13, he says this, and this is actually, I'm translating this from the Russian, so forgive me here, but it says, since equality often leads to quarrels, God established many forms of power and submission, such as that between husband and wife, son and father, old man and young man, slave and a free man, between a manager and a subordinate, teacher and student. And the lack of this authority is evil everywhere and is a cause of disorder. There are countless blessings from the authorities that come from state. If they're abolished, everything will die and nothing will stand. The strong will absorb the weak. Now, the notion of the strong absorbing the weak just begs the question. According to the extreme Lutheran view, if the strong then takes over because they're strong, wouldn't that then be the legitimate power that comes from God in that interpretation? St. John Chrysostom, and you see it elsewhere, is interpreting that passage and as having far more to do with authority as such. Authority that might manifest in coercive power. That without hierarchy, there isn't anything. Even the most hardcore anarchist has to lecture people to teach them about what anarchy is. Therefore, there's automatically a hierarchy there. There's automatically a position of authority that they're in. You can't get away from it. You can't deny this. Every liberal professor, an anarchist professor, usually runs their classroom and their department like with an iron fist. So it's good for everything else but him. But then there's a notion that there's benefits that come simply from order as such. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, even relative to the Soviet government, didn't like the idea of privatization of Soviet assets to happen overnight. As evil as the Soviet government was, at least it gave a modicum of peace such that we can slowly get people used to living in a rational society. So we could use some of those institutions just for a short period of time to gradually get people used to a post-communist world. That's not what happened. You had shock treatment. These people wanted their money now. And there, of course, you had the strong absorbing the weak, which is exactly what oligarchy is. That's what Darwin preached. Not just the social Darwinists, Darwin himself preached that. It's the institution of authority as such, an authority that has some connection to power. It makes sense out of our lives. It orders things. It prevents chaos. Chaos comes from a lack of authority. All the authority forms that I mentioned there are legitimate ones. You have servants and managers and old and young teacher student. These are all hierarchies, but they're legitimate ones, and they're connected to a specific field. Again, they're not abstract. These hierarchies exist, whether it be in, it could be music, it could be the state, it could be family, whatever it is, based on those criteria. Great Father, St. Isidore of Pelusium, says this, in part two of his works, his sixth letter. Therefore, we have the right to say that it's the power, that is the authorities and the monarch's power, which is established by God. The power is such, if some wicked man take over and delight in this power, we don't say it was created by God, but we do say that he allowed these people to vomit this, like as to the Pharaoh, and in this case to endure extreme punishment or to prudently correct those who need this, as the king in Babylon wisely judged the Jews. So the concept here is that authority as such is what's being discussed here. The Apostle Paul says elsewhere in 1 Timothy, he says, again, I'm translating this from the Russian, I should have just went to the English, but so first of all, I ask you to perform prayers, petitions, prayers, thanksgiving for all people, for kings and for all rulers, that we can lead a quiet and peaceful life in all piety and purity, for it's good and pleasing to our Savior God, who wants all people to be saved and attain the knowledge of the truth. That's the criteria. Piety and purity. Simply put, power that is from God punishes the evil and gives praise to the good. That's the use of the sword. That's how we know that one power is established by God and one is established by man. The authorities recognize legitimate violence against evil, and it's a necessary evil, but it does happen, and it has to be done. It has to be done to eradicate evil, not good. No one likes to get a limb amputated, but if it means the gangrene is going to spread to the entire body, you have to chop it off. Doesn't mean it's a good thing, but overall, of course, it is a good thing. Goodness is objective, not subjective. Yes, you no longer have a hand, but you're still alive. So this is why the authorities use legit. This is the argument for capital punishment. This is the argument for an actual war on drugs, rather than the ridiculous nonsense we have now. A war, an actual war, like you would have in a regular declared war overseas. Open carrying of the sword doesn't mean it's direct use, but it means that the authorities won't fail to use it. And that it's used solely for the sake of frightening evil people. That's the issue. It's to punish evil and to reward the good. And again, the apostle said this elsewhere. You know, the ministers of God-established authority are constantly engaged in encouraging good deeds and in punishing evil. And this is why they're owed taxes, as St. Paul says. But it has to be for something clearly good. I'm talking about perfection here. But we're talking about the common good rather than a particular good. St. Paul says, well, what is goodness here? He says, well, so to give everyone credit. To whom to give, to whom to rent, rent, whom to fear, fear, whom honor, you honor. Do not remain indebted to anyone except in mutual love. For he who loves the other has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, do not commit adultery, do not kill, do not steal, do not give false testimony, do not wish or covet someone else's. And all the others are contained in this word, love your neighbor as yourself. Again, I was translating that directly from the Russian, because I'm reading Russian text right now. But this is what goodness is. This is what the sword has to be used for. Otherwise, the government is not a government at all. I'm almost out of time. My Lord. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about, of course, was Caesar. The concept of the coin that has, you know, Caesar's picture on it, and they try to trap Christ into saying either, yes, you can pay taxes to Caesar, in which case he'd be pro-Roman, like go to the zealots and say, oh yeah, he's a stooge. Or he says, no, you don't have to, in which case they can go to Caesar and say he's fomenting rebellion. It was a trick they used in Mark 12 and Matthew 22. It's how the Pharisees tried to manipulate Christ, and he failed. And they failed because he didn't answer the question directly, because they didn't understand it. They wouldn't understand a direct answer anyway. Now, notice that they did talk about Caesar, and he says this over and over again. This doesn't necessarily mean they're talking about any form of government or any form of state. The Orthodox and even the Catholic understanding of government comes from the Roman Empire. Why use the Caesar? Caesar's a title, of course. It's the universal law that we owe obligations to. St. John Chrysostom interprets it like this. When you hear this command to render to Caesar things that are of Caesar, know that such things are only intended, which nothing is opposed to religion. If there such be, it's no longer Caesar's, but the devil's tribute. And moreover, that they might not say that he was subjecting them to man. He adds, unto God the things that are God's. This is the legitimacy here. We're talking about the very nature of political science. Now, I have to make it clear, I've said this a long time ago, a lot of people who don't like monarchy will talk about the prophet Samuel and act like this was the populations demanding a monarch so they could be like everybody else. Because they were stubborn about it, God relented, and Samuel consecrated the first monarch. This is not how it should be understood. When they say that they want to be like other kingdoms, kingdom is used abstractly. The kingdoms surrounding them were, in fact, oligarchies. Either the king didn't exist or the king was a figurehead. But that's exactly what they're talking about. They want to be oligarchs. They want to be involved in commercial relations and charge interest and buy up all the land and rule people through money. That's what they meant when they said we want to be like everybody else, so give us a king. In other words, give us a king that we can control. And who was doing this? The entire population? No, those who were there were probably already those people who had money, who had were in a position to take advantage of this. So the consecration of Saul, David, and unfortunately Solomon. And of course Solomon was, you know, sort of the Peter the Great of the ancient world. This is, it gives us a sense of the dangers of political rule. That this is not something to be sought after. But in the Old Testament, the concept of a monarch is to give the Old Testament people a sense of the coming Messiah. The Jewish Messiah, of course, is going to be Antichrist, either as a literal person or as the so-called new man of the left revolutionaries, Adam Kadmon. The Antichrist, as Christ said, I have come in the name of my Father, and you don't accept me, but if another comes in his own name, receive him. Your father is a devil, and you want to fulfill the lusts of your father. In the Gospel of John, this is what he says to the Jews, his enemies. In the first centuries of the church, they did not have a monarch. The pagan Roman emperors, the apostles respected only the principle of power. Because they did limit, compared to what we have today, the Stoic mentality was utopia compared to postmodern America. It did limit the forces of evil. It did limit lawlessness. It did oppose chaos. The great victory was to overthrow the hostile monarchy. And starting with Constantine, and then of course reaching its fruition with Theodosius the Great, founding the Second Rome. So you had the power of the church, the power of government, united in the principle of symphony. As I mentioned many times, the Emperor Justinian and the Patriarch of Constantinople, Phocius, both saints. And remember, this is not limited to the standards of the earthly world. When Christ said, my kingdom is not of this world, he's talking about power. He's talking about politics. He's not talking about universal laws. He's not talking about justice. Justice is something that we fight for. You can't say, well, I'm not going to fight for anything good because the kingdom is not of this world. And if I fight for it, it's of this world. That's ridiculous. That's obviously not what he meant. There's no question about it. The symphony, I have two lectures I did about a year ago on the question of the symphony of power, which is also very much misunderstood. But remember, the emperor, starting Constantine onward, this was a bishop, in a sense, of those outside of the church. He had a right to convene ecumenical synods, and it was accepted that nothing in that society had legal status unless he gave it legal status. And he represented the unity of law. He represented the unity of the nation, of the people. He represented the unity of goodness, and he was a mirror of the heavens. There's a mistranslation from St. John of Kronstadt saying that heaven is a monarchy, hell is a democracy. No, hell is a tyranny. But the concept is that one is based on the good, one is not. Natural law, canon law, the traditions of our people, this is what restrains the forces of evil. Either Antichrist specifically or the Antichrist. And then Russia, of course, takes this over after the Turks took the Second Rome. So these two biblical passages have been manipulated and, like so much else, destroyed and mistranslated and misused. It's not what they mean. Keep in mind that the essential concept is the distinction between power and authority and where authority comes from. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with coercion. There's nothing wrong with violence or even killing. Murder is a problem because murder by definition is evil. It's like torture is by definition evil. The infliction of pain, though, isn't necessarily evil. It depends on why. These are not bad things. We don't like them, but these are not bad things. These are medications. When you understand these things medicinally, rather than as legal standards, you come closer to what the Orthodox mentality really is. And don't forget, I'll leave you with this. St. Basil the Great prayed for the killing of the tormentor of the church, Julian the Apostate, who was supported by the oligarchy of Jews at the time. And there are several psalms that are nothing more than prayers for suffering to come upon your enemies. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that, so long as it's not your personal enemies, but rather enemies of the church. Anyway, thank you for listening, everyone. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.